following program is intended for mature audiences.
They used to bounce messages across the earth.
Shows. Everyone in the old world had a show.
Do you think there's still somebody out there? Sending shows?
Who knows? Those are the planes of silence.
Jumpy tune. Hey, nothing says Moscow like an American banjo in a New Orleans jazz band. This was the 1963 hit Midnight on Moscow by the Village Stompers. This was the upbeat and jazzy New Orleans-y type of Americanization of a Russian song. Much more dirge-like, just from a year ago, when times were darker and we needed a laugh.
Security and of the entire Western Hemisphere, and under the authority entrusted to me by the Constitution, as endorsed by the resolution of the Congress, I have directed that the following initial steps be taken immediately. To halt this offensive buildup, a strict quarantine on all offensive military equipment under shipment to Cuba is being initiated. All ships of any kind bound for Cuba, from whatever nation or port, will, if found to contain cargoes of offensive weapons, be turned back. It shall be the policy of this nation to regard any nuclear missile launched from Cuba against any nation in the Western Hemisphere as an attack by the Soviet Union on the United States, requiring a full retaliatory response upon the Soviet Union. I call upon Chairman Khrushchev to halt and eliminate this clandestine, reckless, and provocative threat to world peace.
At 12 years old, there was little comfort in knowing that I was not alone, but joined by tens of millions of people around the world in this great fear. I know I could have used a laugh. I know the whole world could have. And that's where Alan Sherman comes in.
Is this 418-9749?
Speaking.
Sarah?
Yeah.
Sarah Jockman, Sarah Jockman. How's by you? How's by you? How's by you to family? How's your sister Emily?
She's nice too.
She's nice too.
Jerry Bachman, Jerry Bachman, so what's new?
What you doing, Sarah?
Reading John O'Hara.
He's nice, too.
He's nice, too.
Sarah Jockman, Sarah Jockman, how's by you? How's by you? How's your brother, Bernie?
He's a big attorney.
How's your sister, Doris?
Still with William Morris.
How's your cousin, Shirley?
She got married early.
How's her daughter, Esther?
Skipped a whole semester.
How's your brother, Bentley?
Feeling better mentally.
How's your cousin, Ida?
She's a freedom rider.
What's with Uncle Sidney?
They took out a kidney.
How's your sister, Norma?
She's a nonconformer.
How's your cousin, Lena?
Moved to Pasadena.
How's your Uncle Nathan?
Him I got no faith in.
I ain't heard from Sonia.
I'll get her to phone ya.
How's her daughter, Rita?
A regular Lolita.
How's your cousin Manny?
Signed up with Vic Tanny.
How's your nephew Seymour?
Seymour joined the Peace Corps.
He's nice too. He's nice too. Sarah Jockman, Sarah Jockman. How's
Jerry
by
Bachman,
you?
Jerry
How's by
Bachman,
you?
So
give regards to High now.
So
gotta say goodbye
new.
Now.
Give
Toodaloo.
Regards to Mo now. Well,
Toodaloo.
I gotta go now.
Toodaloo.
Toodaloo. Toodaloo.
Are you ready? Are you ready?
We're ready. We're ready. Yeah, we're ready.
And make-believe. It's the Vino Veritas. Featuring host, writer, humorist, experiential mystic, raconteur, and parallel parking expert, Tom Savino. Now, here he is with Savino Veritas in Wine the Truth, Tom Savino.
Greetings, everyone. Tonight we'll be listening to the parodies of Alan Sherman and talking to author, biographer, Mark Cohen, whose book, Overweight Sensation, is all about the life of Alan Sherman. So stay with us. On October the 26th, 1962, it wasn't clear everything would be okay and the Cuban Missile Crisis would not lead to nuclear war. There were 2 days to go in the 13-day showdown between the United States and the Soviet Union. Missile construction in Cuba charged ahead and Fidel Castro urged the Soviets to bomb America if the United States invaded Cuba. It was a good day to count your blessings, especially if you were a top government official in Washington. So Newton N. Minow, chairman of the Federal Communications Commission, wrote a note of thanks to Alan Sherman. He wrote, "Dear Alan Sherman, my son, the folk singer, has brought brightness into our lives in some difficult hours here. It's very, very funny." And President Kennedy's special assistant, Arthur Schlesinger Jr., in November 6, 1962, wrote a note to Alan Sherman saying, "I can't say how much we have enjoyed this record." Hello, everyone. Tom Savino here with Savino Veritas. What I just read you that account was the prologue, or from the prologue, of Overweight Sensation, written by Mark Cohen, a biographer and researcher, an expert in Alan Sherman. And he's in San Francisco, and he'll be joining us right now on Savino Veritas.
Veritas is satire spelled backwards, with a V for victory.
After sharing notes about each of our backgrounds, I shared with Mark my respect for Alan Sherman. Alan was actually a big influence on me.
Well, he was the best. I don't think there's anyone been any better.
Did you know Alan personally?
No, he died in 1973. I was a high school student back then, so no, I never knew him. But I grew up in New York City. Are you a New Yorker? Where are you
yes,
from?
Yes, from Brooklyn, New York, from Benson Heights.
Yeah, I'm from Queens. And so I grew up with his albums in my house. And by the time I was in high school, me and my friends in the early 70s, we all knew Alan Sherman. We had the albums in our homes. And, you know, he was just really, really funny. He was terrific. We loved him. And then a number of years ago, I had begun writing some things following an illness where I kind of turned my attention to doing some things that I had always wanted to do but hadn't done. And I was looking around for a project, thought about, you know what had happened? I had run across Sherman's autobiography, which I didn't even know existed. Just accidentally found it in a bookstore and read it and thought it was, you know, really pretty good. And that the story of his life had never been the subject of a good objective biography. And I started looking into it. And I wrote the liner notes to the box set that came out from Warner Brothers in, I think, 2005. And then I wrote another article about him. And I started becoming the expert on Sherman. And I wrote a book proposal. And I got a, you know, a contract with Brandeis University Press. And I wrote the book. And it turned out to be a terrific story. The book was well received. And it's, I've been looking at it recently again, because I'm writing another book now. And man, that Sherman book is good, Tom.
I asked Mark Cohen about the title of the book, Overweight Sensation.
That's correct.
And did, he died, 40, he was 49, I think, when he died.
Yeah, so, it was a couple of days shy of his 49th birthday, yeah.
Mark went on to talk about Alan's father's obesity.
His dad, at a certain point, among his father's community down in Birmingham, Alabama, he was known as Mr. 5x5. There was an old song called Mr. 5x5, 5 foot high and 5 foot wide, and that's how Sherman's father was known as well.
Mark shared details on Alan Sherman's childhood.
Yeah, Alan Sherman's childhood was a very formative and lasting influence on his life, mainly for the worse. His parents were two very unstable people, dissatisfied with what fate had dealt them in terms of their identities and backgrounds. His mother and father were both immigrants to this country who arrived here in the very early 1900s as little children. 4, 5, 6 years old. They were both Jewish immigrants from Eastern Europe. Mm-hmm. And they both grew up in very American cities. His mother in Chicago, his father in Birmingham, Alabama. Both embraced their new American surroundings passionately and found each other in Chicago in the 1920s when Sherman's father had moved from Birmingham to Chicago to work in the car garage business. His father was a gifted mechanic, loved fast cars, racing. And Sherman was born in Chicago to these two parents in 1924. And it was a very unstable family setup. His parents soon moved with Alan, whose name at birth was Alan Copelon, C-O-P-E-L-O-N. And they moved to L.A. And by 1930, when Alan was 6, his parents were divorced. But even prior to the divorce, the divorce records of his parents show what kind of emotional violence was going on in the home, with supposedly his father brandishing a gun and saying that he's going to kill his wife, and the mother screaming and yelling and leaving home and taking all the money. And it was just absolute insanity. And in Sherman's autobiography, he talked passionately, and he would mention it over and over throughout his life, that when he was about 5 or 6 years old, his mother approached him and said, "You have to choose, who do you want to live with, me or your father?" And he felt that that moment of having to choose between his parents was a violent emotional blow that he never fully recovered from. And one of the ways that moment manifested itself throughout his life and in his work and some of his best songs was a was an attachment to childhood and a distrust of adulthood and parents. Some of his greatest songs, like One Hippopotami and, of course, Hello Mudda, Hello Fada, are songs that appeal greatly to children or are about children, like in Hello Mudda, who are away from home, who are homesick, who are longing for their parents. And one of Sherman's great comedic achievements was being able to transform the pain of that early childhood experience into the great childhood comedy that he ended up writing.
Hello, Mudda. Hello, Fada. Here I am at Camp Granada. Camp is very entertaining, and they say we'll have some fun if it stops raining. I went hiking with Joe Spivey. He developed poison ivy. You'll remember Leonard Skinner. He got ptomaine poisoning last night after dinner. All the counselors hate the waiters, and the lake has alligators. And the head coach wants no sissies, so he reads to us from something called Ulysses. Now I don't want this to scare you, but my bunkmate has malaria. You remember Jeffrey Hardy? They're about to organize a searching party. Take me home, oh Mudda Fada, take me home. I hate Granada, don't leave me out in the forest where I might get eaten by a bear. Take me home, I promise I will not make noise or mess the house with other boys. Oh, please don't make me stay. I've been here one whole day. Dearest Fada, darling Mudda, how's my precious little brother? Let me come home if you miss me. I would even let Aunt Bertha hug and kiss me. Wait a minute, it stopped hailing. Guys are swimming, guys are sailing, playing baseball. Gee, that's better. Mudda Fada, kindly disregard this letter. One hippopotami cannot get on a bus, because one hippopotami is two hippopotamus. And if you have two goose, that makes one geese. A pair of mouse is mice, a pair of moose is me. Paranoia is a bunch of mental blocks. And when Ben Casey meets Kildare, that's called a paradox. When two minks fall in love with all their heart and soul, you'll find the plural of two minks is one mink stole. Singulars and plurals are so different.
bless my soul. Has it ever occurred to you that the plural of half is whole? A bunch of tooth is teeth. A group of foot is feet. And two canaries make a pair. They call it a parakeet. A paramecium is not a pair. Nobody knows just what a paraphernalia is, and what is half a pair of scissors? It's a single sizz with someone you adore. If you should find romance, you'll pant and pant once more.
You're listening to Savino Veritas, and I'm speaking today with Mark Cohen in San Francisco, who is the biographer of Alan Sherman, who wrote the book Overweight Sensation. Mark told me of the great influence of Alan's Jewish and Yiddish background and how much that influenced all of his work, including songs that took in other cultures, like an Irish ditty.
I sell a line of plastics, and I travel on the road, and I have a case of samples, which, believe me, is a load. Every night a strange cafe, a strange hotel, and then early in the morning I am on the road again. When the season's over and my lonesome journey ends, that's the only time I see my family and my friends. I drive up Ocean Parkway, and before I stop the car, my ma leans out the window and she hollers, "Here we are. Shake hands with your Uncle Max, my boy. And here is your sister Cheryl. And here is your cousin Isabel. That's Irving's oldest girl. And you remember the Tishman twins, Gerald and Jerome. We all came out to greet you and to wish you welcome home. Meet Merowitz, Barowitz, Handelman, Chandelman, Sperber and Gerber and Steiner and Stone. Moskowitz, Lupowitz, Ahrens and Behrens, Kleinman and Feynman and Friedman and Cohn. Smolowitz, Wolowitz, Teitelbaum, Mandelbaum, Levin, Levinsky, Levine and Levi. Brumberger, Schlumberger, Minkus and Dinkus and Stein with an E-I and Stein with a Y. Shake hands with your Uncle Sal, mine boy. And here is your brother Sid. And here is your cousin Yetta, who expects another kid. Whenever you're on the road, mine boy, wherever you may roam, we'll all be here when you come back to wish you well.
I asked Mark about Alan's record as a television producer.
He was a pretty successful television producer for many years, and he did some specials for the wonderful comic and parodist Victor Borge.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. So there were influences out there that had an effect on him. There was another song I was thinking of with regard to childhood and the perfect family. Oh, Here's to the Crabgrass. That's on the My Son the Nut album.
Okay, Here's to the Crabgrass.
Here's to the Crabgrass, which is a wonderful parody of an English song, a British song, and in it he attacks the notion of the idyllic suburb and the beautiful life that awaits American families in the suburbs. Keep in mind, this is 1963. From our perspective now, it seems very early, but actually when you look at the literature of the time, and specifically the Jewish American literature, things like Philip Roth's Goodbye Columbus, which is an exploration of the city-suburb divide. Yeah, with Here's to the Crabgrass, he writes a wonderful song about the suburb-city divide and the love-hate relationship with the city and the suburb and the inability of the parents. It's a dialogue between parents in Here's to the Crabgrass about where should they live. Should they live in the suburbs or the city? They move to the suburbs, then they want to go back to the city. And it was a wonderfully prescient song about the ongoing battle that would take place in American life about this very major transformation sociologically in American life. And that's another aspect of Sherman's terrific feel, almost clairvoyant feel for the moods and shifts and changes that he was able to observe and detect and sense and feel deeply about American life. He can be easily underrated, but I hope in my book I was able to make a strong case for his importance is the kind of obnoxious word that you use when you don't have anything else good to say about someone. And I hate that term, but he needs to be thought of, I think, in a more respectful way, because he really was more than just a guy who wrote one funny song called Hello Mudda, Hello Fada.
At this point in our conversation, Mark and I made a toast. Here's to the Crabgrass.
Complicated.
parodies that illustrate what Mark was talking about Alan's ability to really comment on the culture and the society, are Chim Chim Cheree and the TV-addicted couple Hal and Yetta.
Chimney, chim, chimney, chim, chim, cheree. Those are three words that don't make sense to me. But I'm used to words that don't make sense to me from all those commercials I see on TV. When I see an ad that can't be understood, I know that the product has got to be good. Those words may be crazy, but I think they're great. Like sodium acetyl salicylate. I wake up each morning a most happy man. I cover my Pico Pay with Fluoristan. I add hexachlorophene 'cause it's so pure, and then GL70 just to make sure. Then I take a shower, but never alone. I'm in there with Dermacil and silicone. I brush Vitrol D on my lanolin wave, and I sharpen my boo-boo and use it to shave.
He sharpens his boo-boo, and that's how he shaves.
There's Tufsin and Redsin and Acrolan too, and Marfac and Melmac, and what else is new? There's Orlon and Corlon, and there's Accutron, and Teflon and Banlon, and so on and on. These wonderful words spin around in my brain. Each one is a mystery I cannot explain. Like, what does that blue magic whitener do? Does it make blue things white or make white things blue?
His blue things are white and his white things are blue.
My fastback has wide track and autronic eye, which winks when a cute little Volvo goes by. My tank full of platform 8 starts with a roar, but when I try to stop, it goes 2 miles more. I measure my breathing with my nasograph. It's nice, but oh my, how it hurts when I laugh. My chair is upholstered in real Naga hide. When they killed that Naga, I sat down and cried.
He moved to Chicago when that Naga died.
I'm giving a party next Saturday night, and here are the friends that I'm going to invite. The giant who lives in my washing machine, that other nice giant who's jolly and green. The tiger who causes my gas tank to flood, that handsome white knight who is stronger than crud. The man with the eye patch who sells me my shirts, and that nut who flies into the front seat for hurts.
That daring young nut who goes flying for hurts.
I've lived all my life in this weird wonderland. I keep buying things that I don't understand, 'cause they promise me miracles, magic, and hope. But somehow it always turns out to be soap. And they might as well be Chim Chimney Cheree.
Those words are Chim Chimney Cheree.
Yeah.
TV addiction.
Noting the satirical elements aimed at television and the advertising industry, I asked Mark Cohen how Alan got into the television industry.
It was the very early days of television, the early to mid-1950s. It might have even been 52 or 53. I'd have to consult my book to remember the exact year. What happened was, he attended the University of Illinois for college. Mm-hmm. His dream in the years 1942, 43, 44, 45, when he was in college, before television was a sensation or even a reality, was to write for the Broadway stage.
Oh.
So he went to New York after college to try and fulfill his dream of writing a musical. These are the years in New York, on Broadway, considered the golden age of the American musical, with Oklahoma and Brigadoon. And just if you look at any brief overview of the Broadway stage, and I can't rattle off all the names right now, it was the great moment of the Broadway stage, and he was enormously enamored of it. And he went to New York City, and he wrote. And he wrote sketch comedy for comedians and nightclub acts and tried to write, and in fact did succeed in writing, a Broadway play called The Golden Touch, a fable, which was a reworking of the Midas touch, where everything you touch turns to gold. Mm-hmm. The Golden Touch, about a busboy in a Jewish delicatessen who sells his soul to the devil to make enough money to marry his sweetheart. And the deal with the devil demands that the Jewish deli become a French restaurant and its ethnic and culinary history be denied and transformed. And they make money and everything's wonderful, except his girlfriend falls out of love with him because this wasn't the man she was attracted to. She was attracted to the Jewish busboy. So at the end of the story, of course, he goes back to being his true self. It's one of the best early examples of his attempt to work out a Jewish American theme in entertainment that he would be attracted to for the next 30 years or the rest of his life. The show, the script, made its rounds in New York, and I actually found New York Times references to the script. Mm-hmm. And there was even talk in 47 that it would be produced on Broadway. And in what seems to be a possible inspiration for Mel Brooks's later play, The Producers.
Ah, yes.
Mm-hmm. About producers who raise money for plays in order to steal the money, not to put on the play, or to put on a play that they hope will be a flop so they can steal the money. The backers of Sherman's play turned out to be crooks who collected the money and ran off with the money. And it was
Seriously?
Yes, yes. And it was a terrible blow to Sherman, terrible. Because,
well, yes, I could laugh about it now, but I am sure he was very, very upset by that.
You imagine he's 23 years old, it's 1947, and he's newly married to his college girlfriend, Dee Golden, Dolores D. Golden, mm-hmm. and D.E.E. is how she, her nickname. And he thought he's on the cusp of having a play produced, a musical produced on Broadway. That didn't happen. And he remained in New York. He was well known to people in the writing game. TV was coming on board in the early 50s, late 40s, early 50s. The show What's My Line had already been a hit on television. He and a friend dreamed up a kind of takeoff on What's My Line called I've Got a Secret. They pitched it to the Goodson-Todman group, mm-hmm. an enormously successful television producing group.
Oh, yes.
And they took it. And Sherman became a producer on the show. And that's where he started.
That's how he got into TV. That's great.
How he got into TV. Yeah. And he even wrote a once or twice produced little play about television that I quote from in the book. And there's a speech that's given by one of the characters in the play about the mad, unformed moment of early television where everyone was flying by the seat of their pants and no one knew what this new medium was all about. And it was wide open. And people like Sherman, without any background in the field, no one had any background in the field. It was a new field, could find a place in television. It was one of those wonderful moments where you're at the birth of a business and everyone's winging it. And Sherman, as the complete non-organization man, the disorganization man, as he called himself in his own autobiography, needed always that kind of business to fit into, because otherwise he could not fit in. He was, I'm a big Saul Bellow fan, the novelist Saul Bellow.
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm.
And Bellow was very sympathetic to this character type. And he once said in one of his novels about people who go into academia, you know, if you're too mad to sit at a desk all day and you can't fill out forms and attend meetings, then you need an institution, a higher institution. So you go into academia, you work at a university. And in the same way, Sherman was, you know, too mad to sit at a desk all day and fill out memos. He needed an institution, you know.
Yeah.
And he found these unformed, newly created institutions or organizations or businesses or industries where he was able to play a role without being subject to organizational rules that had been long in place and developed. So he's living in New York. I'll just follow this thread for a little while.
Sure.
Living
yeah.
in New York in the mid 1950s, he's got a good stable job. He's making a decent salary. He and his wife, and by now their two children, move to Westchester County. They buy a very nice home, and he develops a large friendship group within the TV community. He starts to know a lot of people in the TV industry. He has this wonderful, wonderful time in the 50s where there are these terrific house parties at the homes of people in the business. And it's just an enviable time. You read about these parties, and I interviewed the children of some of Sherman's friends from those days, and actually some of his own friends who are still alive in their very late 80s or 90s. And these are parties with all the actors and the comics and the studio musicians and the studio musicians' jazz friends and dancer friends. And it was just a wild group of these guys in their 30s and 40s in the 1950s who were born in the 20s, typically to Jewish immigrant parents in wholly ethnic Jewish neighborhoods from poor backgrounds on the whole, who suddenly find themselves living in the 1950s in the suburbs of New York during America's greatest post-war period of affluence, and just living it up and pinching themselves that they're enjoying this extraordinary life where they have homes with backyard pools and they're working in television and music and they're making money, and it's just wonderful. It's just this wonderful moment. Sherman becomes friends with the drummer on the NBC orchestra. And anyway, he would go to this fella's house often and sing parodies that Sherman had been writing in his free time after work. And these were Jewish parodies of the Broadway musicals then on Broadway in New York. And he would refer to these throughout his life. And actually, during his early years of fame, a bootleg album appeared of these Jewish song parodies of Broadway musicals. And he called them the Golden Moments from Broadway. And he introduced these songs. I have a recording of his appearance at his own concert in early 1963 after his fame. And he performed some of these Jewish song parodies. And he introduced them by saying, "I thought up these songs about 6 years ago in the mid-1950s when I thought, what would it have been like, how would it have been if all of the great songs from the great Broadway musicals had been written by Jewish people, which they were." And yes. He then wrote Jewish parodies of songs that had been written by Jews that lacked any Jewish content.
Thank you. About 6 years ago, I wrote what I've always referred to as my masterwork, which is called Golden Moments from Broadway. And what happened was, it occurred to me, what if all of the great hit songs from all of the great Broadway shows had actually been written by Jewish people, which they were. So I rewrote some of them in that fashion, and the one I'd like to sing for you now, I stole from a typical Jewish composer named Meredith Wilson, who comes from the Jewish section of Mason City, Iowa. And I wrote this song after I joined a golf club in Westchester County, New York. And after playing there around 2 or 3 weeks, I suddenly realized that everybody there had something in common. And I wrote this song about it. And it goes like this. And we're going to start pretty soon. "76 Sol Cones in the country club, and 110 nice men named Levine. And there's more than 1,000 Finks who parade around the links. It's a sight that really must be seen. 76 Sol Cones lead the big parade, with 109 Irv Kleins right behind. But the loveliest men I've known are the men they call Sol Cone at that good old country club of mine. Oh, there's Sol the drugstore man and Sol the furrier, Sol from coats, Sol from shoes, Sol the builder too. And one Sol Cone is known as Sol the worrier. He's so rich, what else has he got to do? Oh, there's Sol who manufactures ladies' lingerie, Sol from shirts, Sol from ties, Sol the Commodore. The country club is full of Sols, and all the Sols are living dolls. But who's staying home to watch the store? 76 Sol Cones in the country club, 76 Sol Cones playing gin. But they're hard to identify, 'cause as time goes passing by, one by one, they change their name to Quinn.
Thank
a Jewish version of My Fair Lady. He did a Jewish version of songs from Oklahoma. And also, though it did not fit his thesis, because the plays, The Music Man, the musical, The Music Man, of course, was not written by a Jewish lyricist. It was written by Meredith Willson. But he couldn't resist turning 76 trombones into 76 Saul Cones. So this was the beginning of his Jewish song parody career. These songs that he sang at house parties in the New York suburbs in the 1950s.
Well, as a New York Yankees fan myself, it wouldn't be complete without Alan Sherman's parody of a song from Damn Yankees called You Gotta Have Heart, in this case, Skin.
You gotta have skin. All you really need is skin. Skin's the thing that if you got it outside, it helps keep your insides in. It covers your nose, and it's wrapped around your toes. You put lemon meringue, and outside you hang your clothes. Skin is what you feel at home in, and without it furthermore, both your liver and abdomen would keep falling on the floor. And you'd be dressed in your intestine, a Siamese twin an extra set of skin. When the doctor knows that you're feeling sick, where does he stick his needle in? In the end of your skin. All your friends and all your kin folks, whether poor or whether rich, they have all got lots of skin, folks. It's convenient when they itch. Nothing can match it when you scratch it. It fits perfectly. Yours fits you and mine fits me. When you're sitting down, it folds and looks grand. And then when you stand, it's where it's been. Ain't you glad you got skin? Just a little baby, why your skin fit fine. And it still is gonna fit you when you're 6'9". So whether you're fat, tall, big, small, chubby or thin, ain't you glad you got skin?
One of the things that's happened in the intervening 50 years or so since Sherman's greatest fame is that the prominence of Hello Mudda, Hello Fada has obscured the career that preceded that, the recording career that created his fame initially. And that was in October 1962, almost a year before Hello Mudda, Hello Fada, with the appearance of his first comedy album, My Son, the Folk Singer. And what's extraordinary about his career, and that's been obscured, as I say, by the later fame of Hello Mudda, Hello Fada, is that his first album, My Son, the Folk Singer, appeared in October 62, was a number one hit. It was number one on Billboard's top-selling album LP list. The best-selling album in the country, Gold Record Award. It was the album that got him his concert, cross-country concert tour in early 63 that placed him on The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson over and over and over again. And that album was almost a wholly Jewish parody album. And what's amazing about his career and the social moment of the very early 1960s when that album appeared is the transition, the appeal that album had for America as a whole. That was the most astonishing thing about his fame, was that his fame was not based on a quote-unquote crossover hit of Hello Mother, Hello Father, but he won his first fame and tremendous fame with My Son the Folk Singer, which had songs on it like Shake Hands with Your Uncle Max, which had songs on it like The Streets of Miami, which was a Jewish parody of The Streets of Laredo. And the quote-unquote crossover hit on that album was the very Jewish Sarah Jachman.
We started this episode with Sarah Jachman, so let's take a listen now to The Streets of Miami.
As I wandered out on the streets of Miami, I said to myself, this is some fancy town. I called up my partner and said, hello, Sammy. Go pack up your satchel and mosey on down. I got me a bunk in the old Honey Plaza with breakfast and dinner included, of course. I caught 40 winks on my private piazza. Then I rented a pinto from Hertz Rent a Horse. My partner flew down on a non-scheduled airline. You never did see such a pale-looking man. I recognized him from his receding hairline. He recognized me from my beautiful tan. 'Twas then that I heard fighting words from my partner. He said, Marvin, the Roni is no place to stay. I'm going to the Fontainebleau. Partner, it's Modner. And I'll charge to the firm $60 a day. I said to him, pale face, you hanker for trouble. With the company checkbook, you quick on the draw. He smiled and said, stranger, for me that goes double. 'Cause west of the Fontainebleau, I am the law. Next morning, the whole Lincoln Road was deserted, and somewhere a hi-fi was playing a tune. 'Cause everyone knew someone's gonna be murdered in a duel in the sun on the stroke of high noon. I took careful aim with my trusty revolver. The clock in the Fontainebleau struck 12 o'clock. I shot and Sam crumbled just like a bee's halva. And that's what they call a bad day at Black Rock. They came with a posse and took my 6-gun away. The crowd was too angry to leave me in jail. The sheriff said, "Outlaw, I'm gonna let you run away. But don't ever be seen south of Fort Lauderdale." So now I can never go back to Miami. And New York is so cold that a person could die. I'd be better off dead, like my late partner Sammy, 'cause he's in that big Fontainebleau in the sky.
He's in that big Fontainebleau in the sky.
You're listening to Tom Savino on Savino Veritas, and tonight we are featuring this episode on Alan Sherman and talking with Mark Cohn, who wrote Overweight Sensation, a biography of Alan Sherman. And Mark is now going to break down the chronology of the albums of Alan Sherman.
So first is My Son the Folk Singer in early to mid-October 1962. Actually, it appears in the middle of the Cuban Missile Crisis. And not only that, but thanks to the help of Alan Sherman's son and daughter, who provided me with an enormous trove of papers that only they held, I was able to get my hands on a letter that Alan Sherman received in mid-October 62 from the chairman of the Federal Communications Commission in Washington, saying to him, "Your album has, you know, given us some relief, some light moments during some very difficult times here." Of course, referring to the fact that the whole country was in an uproar about whether or not there'd be nuclear war between the Soviet Union and America. So,
yes, I remember that well. Yes.
So it appeared at a thankfully brief moment of crisis. It passed pretty quickly. It lasted, I think, about 13 days. And that was the album that created the tremendous sensation that was Alan Sherman. And when the album first appeared and was reviewed in Billboard magazine and in Variety magazine, the reviewers, who probably were and certainly considered themselves to be very hip, and could appreciate this kind of Jewish comedy, did not believe that the album would do well. They did not believe that the American public would be able to appreciate or get the humor. And the surprise was that it became the best-selling album in the country. And that did not happen because only Jewish people were buying the album. It happened because it became a mass hit. And that was the astonishing thing about his album. And one of the most perceptive reviews of the album in late 62, was in, I think it was in the Saturday Review, by a fellow who typically reviewed classical music. He was a very educated, sophisticated guy. And he was the one who said that the reaction to the album marks the end of a long suppressed general emotion. And that long suppressed general emotion was ethnic identity. In 1962, there were millions and millions of Americans who had arrived as immigrants during one of the great periods of immigration, one of the classic periods of immigration, the period between 1900 and 1924. In 1962, all those people, virtually all of them, were still alive. They were in their 60s and 70s and 80s.
Yes.
And their children, of course, knew themselves to be the sons and daughters of these immigrants. And they had grown up in immigrant communities, whether Irish or Jewish or Italian. And the song and the songs and the album became the stand-in ethnic experience, the representative ethnic experience for a wide variety of Americans. And it also became fascinating to the non-ethnic Americans who saw a change in the culture taking place. And this was a way to approach it, to learn about it. And of course, the album was an unthreatening album. It wasn't anything like what came later with black comedians like Richard Pryor, mm-hmm. who were much more confrontational and angry, and who were brilliant in their own way. But the country, by the time Pryor came along, was ready for a much harsher kind of comedy. Sherman didn't do that. Sherman's comedy was clever and playful and built on wonderfully sly puns. One of the other songs on My Son the Folk Singer was The Ballad of Harry Lewis, which was a parody of the battle hymn of the Republic. And in he makes a parody of the Grapes of Wrath, and the term, the Grapes of Wrath, that phrase comes from that song, and he turned it into the Drapes of Wrath, talking about the Garment Center warehouse owned by Irving Roth.
I'm singing you the ballad of a great man of the cloth. His name was Harry Lewis, and he worked for Irving Roth. He died while cutting velvet. On a hot July the 4th. But his cloth goes shining on. Perished. In the service of his Lord, he was trampling through the warehouse where the Drapes of Wrath are stored. He had the finest funeral the Union could afford, and his cloth goes shining on. Was raging. Harry stood by his machine. And when the firemen broke in, they discovered him between
pile of roasted Dacron and some French fried gabardine. His cloth goes shining.
So it was wonderfully sly, it was very funny, and it became an enormous sensation.
You're listening to Savino Veritas. This is Tom Savino from Burbank, California, Lion's Den Studios. We're not soundproof, we are not foolproof. We are 90 proof. We will be back with Mark Cohen, who is the author of Overweight Sensation, the biography of Alan Sherman. We'll be listening more to his interview and hearing some more songs and parodies of Alan Sherman right after these messages. Mo, through an exclusive arrangement with Oregon Yeshe, Tibetan divination expert, Savino Veritas listeners may have their tough questions answered. Through the universal synchronicity of Manjushri, seer of all past, present, and future, Gurgin Yeshe reads your questions and throws the dice for you. More importantly, he'll answer your questions based on Manjushri's guidance, which Yeshe will invoke for your reading. The price? $22. Submit $22 to PayPal and one well-thought-out question to tjsavino22@gmail.com.
Should I go to college or not?
What's the best way to advertise my business?
Can I trust my boyfriend to be faithful?
What's the best month for the wedding, May or June?
Will I ever get pregnant?
Who's the best candidate to fill a supervisor's job?
Write a well-thought-out question for which you need an answer. Go to tjsavino@gmail.com. Pay just $11. Write your question and send it to tjsavino22@gmail.com. Deposit the $11 in the PayPal account associated with tjsavino22@gmail.com, and Oregon Yeshe will roll the dice for you, get in touch with Manjushri, the synchronicity of the universe, and have an answer for you within days. Just $11.
Italian restaurant? Well, worry no more. And forget about it, restaurant. Forget about it. Hey, the gang to forget about it has found the ultimate silencer and non-bloody assassinations. Hey, you never have to worry about loud sounds, gunfire, people falling over you, bloody people on top of you. Because of the boys that forget about it have discovered a new way, a silent way of killing. For their assassination victims, they serve them Ebola spaghetti or Ebola spaghetti and meatballs. And the victims, they die silently in the bathroom. You got somebody you want out of your hair? Hey, forget about it. Get them a gift certificate and forget about it. But make sure you specify they try Ebola spaghetti or Ebola spaghetti and meatball or Ebola macaroni. Ebola spaghetti. No gluten-free.
It's here. That democracy we've been waiting to get our hands on. Introducing the new City Bill. The bill by bankers for bankers. Sure, it's a regular last-minute budget bill that just barely keeps the government from shutting down, but it's also your ticket to financial freedom. Here at Citigroup, we know financial reform is about as appealing as testifying before Congress on subprime mortgages. That's why City Bill dismantles reform bit by socialist bit. Once again, you'll be able to revel in the most complex derivative schemes your creative mind can dream up, all with the security of knowing American taxpayers have got your back in the highly unlikely event you fail. After all, 2008 was over 100 years ago. There's a reason banks like us just spent more than $1.2 billion to lobby and develop Citibill. We control over 90% of the $700 trillion derivatives market. So let your imagination run wild. Credit default swaps, frog-backed securities, unicorn dander derivatives, the choice is yours. Wherever your feverish financial mind takes you, with the new Citibill, you've got democracy by bankers for bankers. Past performance is a pretty good guarantee of future results.
Veritas is satire spelled backwards. With a V for victory.
It's the fabulous D show.
All tied up, ready for it.
Veritas is satire spelled backwards. Is satire spelled backwards? With a V for victory.
Savino Veritas in Wine the Truth. This is Artist D.
And Anne Marie from Up All Night on For Culture Radio.
Have you got any wine, Anne Marie?
I'm completely intoxicated.
We love to wine. We drink wine. We listen to Savino Veritas every week at JuiceTalk.com. Don't we love Tom?
Hi, Tom.
Hi, Tom.
How you doing?
Listening to Savino Veritas, live from Burbank, California, land of make-believe and fantasy. And a little bit up north in San Francisco is Mark Cohn, who's been joining us this evening, talking about Alan Sherman and his book, the biography of Alan Sherman, called Overweight Sensation. So let's go back with our interview with Mark Cohn.
It dates from the Civil War. And apparently in 1962, there was a big hit recording of the song by the Mormon Tabernacle Choir. And Sherman parodied that hit recording, that 1962 hit recording, with a Jewish version, The Ballad of Harry Lewis. The first album, if you have it on a disc or the original, the original album, it's probably his most perfect album. It's a brilliant, brilliant album. It's extraordinary. It's great.
That's my son, the folk singer.
The folk singer. That's his very first album, and it's unsurpassed, I think, as a comedy album. It's really one of the great comedy albums that's ever been produced. It's just extraordinary. And one of the wonderful things I discovered in writing the book and researching the book is how well remembered Sherman is among the greatest comedians of our generation today. What I found on YouTube was on Comedians in Cars Getting Coffee, conversation between Jerry Seinfeld and one of his comedian buddies, whose name I'm unfairly forgetting here because he's an enormously talented man. And his friend says to Seinfeld, "You know what I wish would always have happened on Mad Men? They should have introduced Alan Sherman on the show. He should have been part of that moment." And Seinfeld says, "You know, I wonder if Wiener, the producer of the show, had ever thought of that. I'll bet he didn't, because if he did, you had to do it."
Veritas, do over.
Chim-chiminy, chim-chiminy, chim-chim-chiree. Those are three words that don't make sense to me. But I'm used to words that don't make sense to me from all those commercials I see on TV. When I see an ad that can't be understood, I know that the product has got to be good. Those words may be crazy, but I think they're great. Like sodium acetyl salicylate.
Sodium acetyl salicylate.
I wake up each morning a most happy man. I cover my Pico Pay with Fluoristan. I add hexachlorophene, cause it's so pure, and then GL70 just to make sure. Then I take a shower, but never alone. I'm in there with Dermacil and silicone. I brush Vitrol D on my lanolin wave, and I sharpen my boo-boo and use it to shave.
He sharpens his boo-boo, and that's how he shaves.
There's Tufsin and Redsin and Acrolan too, and Marfac and Melmac, and what else is new? There's Orlon and Corlon, and there's Accutron, and Teflon and Banlon, and so on and on. These wonderful words spin around in my brain. Each one is a mystery I cannot explain. Like, what does that blue magic whitener do? Does it make blue things white, or make white things blue?
His blue things are white, and his white things are blue.
My fastback has wide track and autronic eye, which winks when a cute little Volvo goes by. My tank full of platform 8 starts with a roar, but when I try to stop, it goes 2 miles more. I measure my breathing with my nasograph. It's nice, but oh my, how it hurts when I laugh. My chair is upholstered in real Naga hide. When they killed that Naga, I sat down and cried.
He moved to Chicago when that Naga died.
I'm giving a party next Saturday night, and here are the friends that I'm going to invite. The giant who lives in my washing machine, that other nice giant who's jolly and green. The tiger who causes my gas tank to flood, that handsome white knight who is stronger than crud. The man with the eye patch who sells me my shirts, and that nut who flies into the front seat for
Hurts.
I've lived all my life in this weird wonderland. I keep buying things that I don't understand, 'cause they promise me miracles, magic, and hope.
but somehow it always turns out to be soap. And they might as well be Jim Jiminy Jury.
Those words are to be Jim Jiminy Jury.
And then there was a homemade video on YouTube of Larry David's appearance at the Boston Pops concerts that take place in Northern New York every summer.
Mm-hmm.
I forget the name, and he sings. He sings Alan Sherman's parody. Shake hands with your Uncle Max. He sings Shake Hands with Your Uncle Max.
Well, we're not going to shake hands with Mark Cohen because this is just part one. Next week, part two of Alan Sherman, Overweight Sensation, with Mark Cohen and me, Tom Savino from Savino Veritas. Join us again next Thursday night and every Thursday night at 11 p.m. Eastern Time, 8 p.m. Pacific Time, and all the other international times in between, and 24/7 at juicedtalk.com. This is Tom Savino saying take care. See you next week.
Meeting is adjourned. Oh, I am sorry, sir. I didn't mean to overstep my bounds. You say that.
What?
Meeting is adjourned.
It is?
No, you say that, Governor.
What?
Meeting is adjourned.
It is?
The end. By George, he's got it. It is the end.
No, that'll be all. Just be sure to lock the door behind you on your way out. Good night.